This is KUOW's The Record. Happy Monday. I'm Bill Radke. We're going to start this hour on the platform. When Seattle's new light rail stations opened this spring, Sound Transit threw a party. Some people thought it was too lavish, too expensive. Now, Sound Transit's about to ask voters for billions of dollars to build more light rail. And again, critics and regulators are questioning the transit agency's promotional spending. Here's KUOW's investigative reporter, John Ryan.
Sound Transit spent more than $800,000 to celebrate the opening of its light rail stations beneath Capitol Hill and Husky Stadium.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Capitol Hill light rail station is open!
An outside firm got $500,000 to plan and run the event. Sound Transit spent $50,000 on swag like tote bags and little paper trains alone.
What doesn't get funded when you spend that much on trinkets and parties?
I spoke with former King County Councilmember Maggie Fimia inside the new Husky Stadium station. She heads a group of volunteers called SmarterTransit.org. They dug up the public records that revealed how much taxpayer money Sound Transit spent to celebrate two new underground stations. The light rail launch was just one way that Sound Transit tries to interest the public in using transit. The agency spends about $5 million a year on communications and public relations.
It's real money. People have worked hard to pay the taxes, and it should be going into service.
The agency's plan is to saturate the region with advertising, so most commuters will see a Sound Transit ad at least 50 times this year. That includes social media, newspaper ads, and underwriting on KUOW. Fimia doesn't dispute that transit agencies should spend money to draw people out of their cars and onto buses and trains.
This is an unreasonable amount of money. If you've got a good product, you don't need to be spending that much money to sell it.
Jeff Patrick is one of Sound Transit's spokespeople.
When we're going to take the time to advertise, we want to have it at a volume that is going to make a difference. And we have some pretty good evidence our advertising works because we're seeing such high ridership gains in comparison to other regions.
Patrick couldn't say just how much of those ridership gains are due to advertising. To do more than just a he said, she said kind of story, KUOW looked into the advertising and public relations of a half dozen transit agencies up and down the West Coast. We found that Sound Transit spending to drive public interest in its services does stick out, even among agencies that are building major new transit facilities and need to involve the public in that process. For every time someone steps aboard a Sound Transit bus or train, the agency spends about 18 cents on its communications. That's more than at any agency we examined, from Everett to Los Angeles. Communications is just 0.5% of Sound Transit's budget. Patrick says that's not out of line with other transit agencies that have big public works programs. We've got more details at KUOW.org. On top of the expense, there are questions about the legality of Sound Transit's PR. Take this animated video produced in January.
Well, we're Sound Transit, and we've got a plan, as well as an attitude of, yes, we can.
That plan is known as ST3. It's the $54 billion package of mega projects Sound Transit hopes voters will approve in November.
Mass Transit gives choices, and since we're being candid, it's flexible, which means it can be expanded.
So on just hearing that, I would think that that sounds like an advertisement.
Evelyn Lopez is head of the Washington Public Disclosure Commission.
They're also talking about expansion. So that sounds like it may be an advertisement for increasing funding through their ballot measure.
Government agencies are allowed to advertise themselves and ask the public what they want. But trying to influence an election, that would be illegal.
The government has a lot of resources, a lot of people working for it. And if those resources are misused, that really does damage the whole concept of democracy, which is supposed to be from the people, not from the government.
Jeff Patrick with Sound Transit says the agency's PR is about the same this year as it has been in years without a ballot measure.
In a democracy, it's appropriate for a public agency like us to try to be responsive to what people want and put forward proposals that represent public opinion.
The PDC has been looking into Sound Transit's surveys and polls to make sure their questions don't cross the line into campaigning. In response to recent reporting by the Seattle Times, the PDC had Sound Transit delete a question from an online survey. And last week, after KUOW brought that animated video to the PDC's attention, Sound Transit took it off YouTube at the PDC's request.
Now entering Capitol Hill Station, doors to my left.
Light rail-loving Sound Transit and its light rail-hating critics rarely see eye to eye. But the agency says criticism of its big light rail party has made a difference.
Cumulatively, we've heard the criticism that it was too much. And so, as I said, we're going to be reducing our costs going forward.
Patrick says the agency will be more frugal when it opens its next light rail station south of SeaTac Airport this fall. He also disclosed that Sound Transit will be cutting $500,000 off its advertising campaign this year. He says light rail ridership has been high enough since the two new stations opened. The agency realized the advertising wasn't necessary. Reporting from
now entering University of Washington Station,
I'm John Ryan, KUOW News.
The Sound Transit Board of Directors votes this Thursday to put the collection of transit mega projects known as ST3 on your November ballot. And you're listening to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. In the wake of the Orlando shooting, the city of Seattle is offering active shooter training for owners of bars and nightclubs on Capitol Hill. That's going to happen later this afternoon. The idea is to train people how to respond if a shooting happens in their bar. But how could we stop people from becoming perpetrators of mass shootings? Scott MacArthur's been trying to figure that out. He's part of an unseen network of people here in the Northwest who try to identify people who might become shooters and intervene before anything happens. Last year, he told KUOW's Jeannie Yandel that network draws on knowledge from several disciplines,
including mental health, the law enforcement side, and the legal side. Bringing all of those entities together is what is really kind of the formation of a team, right? But what we're practicing is a model on prevention.
How common is this model for prevention around the country?
It's definitely gaining steam. A lot of school districts around the country have implemented a model. Workplaces, large corporations generally have a team model, and municipalities. So different police departments will have that model as well.
And where did the strategy come from? Where did this model grow out of?
As many people may recall, you know, certainly during the mid-80s, there was kind of a flurry of workplace violence-related issues, more targeted violence issues. Down in California, there were celebrities in Hollywood that were being stalked and targeted. So LAPD really kind of started that model down there. And at the same time, the Capitol Police back in Washington, D.C., dealing with a lot of congressional-related targeted threats and other threats against public figures. It was really kind of that 1990 time frame when everybody started kind of collaborating together, and that's kind of what kicked it off.
What happens when someone is identified as a possible threat? What's the first step there? How does a team develop? What happens?
Well, essentially, you know, these types of things can come in from a variety of ways. Family members can report concerns about, you know, their loved ones. Coworkers can report things about their supervisors or employees that work for them. And schools, obviously, with students, right? And so when those reports come in, really the first thing that a professional is going to do is determine, is this an exigent circumstance? Is this an emergency situation that they need to, call 911, for example? Really triaging and stabilizing the incident is the first step.
If there's not a 911 emergency happening, what does a threat assessment team do? How do you work with someone that family members are worried about, that friends are worried about? They're concerned that this person might do something drastic, do something violent.
Well, at that point, you're doing your evaluation part of it. And it's really investigative work to determine what is going on with this individual. What is making them behave in the manner that they're behaving? Do they have problems at home? Is it work that's causing them issues? Is it a problem with other students if it's a school environment? And so really it's digging into their personal background, digging into what's going on with situational factors in their lives, and looking at even positive aspects, right? What do they like to do for hobbies, right? What do they do in their free time? What's their social infrastructure like? You're looking at a number of different criteria related to this, to the individual. Things like weapons acquisition, weapons possession, training. Have they made threats, and what are their motives for those threats? You know, do they have substance abuse issues? Do they have any past history of violence? Things like that. Anger issues. Lots of things to look at. And you know, one person isn't necessarily doing all of that work, right? It's a team approach. You need to have experts that are advising on their expertise related to it. Me, I'm a security and investigations professional. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a lawyer. So I need doctors and lawyers to advise me on, you know, best approaches, for example.
I'm talking with Scott MacArthur. He's a security professional, and he's the president of the Northwest chapter of the Association of Threat Assessment Professionals. You talked a little bit about what a successful intervention might look like. part of that is understanding this person is troubled, as well as troubling to other people, perhaps. This person is probably in pain, too. But what happens when that intervention strategy breaks down? For example, there is an intervention, but then the person leaves town, for example. The threat assessment team no longer has access to that person.
Right. Yeah. Well, the bottom line is, you know, you can't be everywhere at every time. And in general, you know, if an individual leaves a school or transitions to another community, right, and they don't have anything set up, I mean, the important part is reporting, right? That's the critical thing. You need those see something, say something, initial reports to come in to get that on somebody's radar so that they can triage it and figure out if they have an issue there or not.
As a threat assessment professional yourself, you know that there's not a lot of research that looks at this particular strategy and its effectiveness when it comes to mass shootings, for example. It's a relatively new field. Why do you think that this kind of approach can be helpful?
Well, I don't know that it's a new field, right, or a new strategies. And, you know, these are just concepts. These are really implementing aspects of the multidisciplinary approach that bring different things together and kind of break down communication barriers and bring expertise in from one discipline to another. Yes, there are no metrics that I'm aware of. You know, you won't find metrics on how many teams exist, right? There are corporate teams, there are school teams, there are law enforcement teams, hospital teams. You'll rarely hear about success stories. How you measure, you know, whether or not you thwarted an attack is a very, very, it's impossible, basically, right? You can never prove that an individual was going to commit an attack or that they weren't going to commit an attack. But we definitely know that these models work. And that having multidisciplinary teams with different perspectives and engaging with specific individuals and situations, they are effective, because if there's nobody looking at them or trying to do interventions on them, you're going to have individuals out there that aren't getting in front of people. They're not getting the treatment that they need. They're not going to ever get in front of law enforcement. Law enforcement will never know that there's a problem with these individuals. So it's better than doing nothing.
Scott MacArthur, security expert and president of the Northwest Chapter of the Association of Threat Assessment Professionals. He talked with Jeannie Endel last year on the anniversary of the Marysville-Pilchuck High School shooting. This afternoon, the city of Seattle is offering active shooter training to businesses on Capitol Hill. You will hear more about that training from KUOW's Joshua McNichols. Just tune in to KUOW's Morning Edition tomorrow. Meanwhile, on social media and elsewhere, people are asking whether this latest mass shooting in Orlando could change our gun control laws. Last week, Washington's senior U.S. Senator Patty Murray told KUOW why she pushed Republicans to vote on two new gun regulations.
I am just overwhelmed by the feeling that we keep having these kinds of incidents, just as we did in Orlando, and we all come out and our thoughts and prayers go to those who have been hit by this, harmed by this, felt by this, and that's absolutely appropriate, and it ends. And I think many of us feel strongly that we have to do more than that, and now is the time. We just can't stop. And if these common sense measures don't pass, it's just a prime example of how out of touch the GOP is with everyday people.
Those votes are going to happen tonight, and there are Republican versions of the proposals and Democratic versions. Basically, the two ideas are, number one, make it harder for people on the government's terrorist watch lists to buy guns. Number two, run more background checks on people who want to buy guns. That last one is a federal version of something Washington State has already done. We passed a voter initiative a couple of years ago, and now if you buy a gun over the internet or at a private gun show in Washington, you have to undergo a background check. We will take a closer look at those proposals this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered, and you can hear my interview with U.S. Senator Patty Murray at KUOW.org. Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. In my experience, the hard part of parenting is not the stuff you have to do. It's that there's always so much more you could do. The father you're about to meet, he's doing a lot. He's introduced his daughter to one of my favorite things, audio storytelling.
Broadcasting all the way from Emerald City. It's Ellie's Podcast 11.
That is 6-year-old Ellie Suastez, and with the help of her father, Abe, Ellie has interviewed a violinist with the Seattle Symphony, a social worker on the homelessness crisis, and even chief of the Seattle Police Department, Kathleen O'Toole. Abe Suastez told me how he first came up with the idea to start a podcast with his daughter.
We received a book 2 years ago for Christmas. It was called Make Her Dad, and it's about projects to do with your daughter. So I told Ellie about the podcast. I showed her what podcasts were. And within the next few days, she had told all of her friends at church, all of her friends at in the neighborhood, that she was going to make a podcast with her dad.
Why did you want to make a podcast, Ellie?
Because I wanted to learn about other people. And I wanted to learn about how their life went.
Ellie, who's been your favorite person to interview in your podcast?
I'd say Lisa Barson, because I interviewed a violinist and...
Lisa is a violinist?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
She is in the symphony.
She's in the Seattle Symphony?
Mm-hmm.
What did you learn from interviewing Lisa?
That you can do anything.
I noticed, Abe, that... you said on the podcast that Ellie had told you one thing she couldn't do was be a firefighter. Tell me about that.
So we moved to Seattle from Arizona, and the small town where we lived, there were no female firefighters. And I was going through a fire science program. And one day she came almost crying and she said, "Dad, I don't want to be a firefighter anymore." And I said, "Why?" She said, "Because there is no girl firefighters. And I can't be a girl, a firefighter unless I'm a boy." I said, "No, you can do anything you want to do." So when we moved here to Seattle, we interviewed two Seattle firefighters, and that just began opening up things for Ellie to realize that she can do whatever she wants.
Ellie's raising her hand now. Is there something you'd like to say?
I was just waving at Carly.
Waving at your sister across the glass?
Mm-hmm.
Who do you want to interview next, Ellie?
Well, I'm thinking the mayor.
The mayor of Seattle?
Mm-hmm.
What would you ask him?
Well, I'd ask him a few things just to help other people.
Like what would that be?
Like building a little shelter, like a little home for the homeless.
You wanted to ask him about that? Mm-hmm. Or you want him to do
if
something?
It's okay if we can do it.
Tell me about this shelter.
I decided that we can ask our church if we can use some of the mattresses so we can make a little cozy bed for there, and then get a bit of quilts, and then we can have like a table and then a bit of fruits and vegetables. In a bowl, like, on it.
You know, I've noticed that you seem really interested in helping people. You talked to some firefighters on your podcast. You interviewed someone who does help homeless people, Jeff Lilly from the Union Gospel Mission.
Yeah.
I've interviewed him, too. But you seem like you're interested in meeting people who help other people. Is that true? Why is that?
Because I wanted to learn how to help others and how to know how to do that.
Ellie is homeschooled.
Correct.
Right? Why did you decide to homeschool her?
Homeschooling allows us for us to do more things like this, to teach her something that's gonna be helpful in her life, or for her to explore other avenues other than just traditional schooling.
Well, that was what interested me immediately about this, Abe, is that you've taken the time and the attention to do something big. You know, a lot of kids go to school and come home and do their homework and do their chores, and I guess I'm always thinking about what else could my kid's childhood be, and so I admire that you launched something that didn't exist with Ellie right there with you.
Right. And it's not that we are against traditional education. You know, we come from a family of teachers, and it's just that allowed us for us to do a little bit more of what we found just to be important in our family. Again, that sense of adventure, that sense of what else can we be doing.
Abe, how have you seen Ellie change through this project?
Believe it or not, her language skills have grown a lot. She's doing a lot of ums and ums, but she's learned a lot of vocabulary. When we started, I wrote every single one of the questions, and now she's writing her own questions and reading them as we interview people. But more than that, she's just more interested in helping people.
Ellie Suastez, along with her father, Abe, are the creators of Ellie's Podcast 11. Following our conversation, Ellie actually interviewed me for her podcast. Very proud of that. You can hear the conversation at our website, kuow.org. You can also hear Ellie's Podcast 11 online. We'll tweet out the link for you right now, at KUOW. You're with The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. North Korean officials are warning a Linwood man, stop criticizing our country. Kenneth Bae was working as a missionary in North Korea in 2014 when he was imprisoned, accused of trying to overthrow the North Korean government. Well, after he was released, Bae came home and gave media interviews, including one to KUOW's Kim Malcolm. Kim asked Kenneth what questions his North Korean prison guards asked him.
How much do you make in the United States? What is it like to live in the U.S.? And do people really have house and cars? And these are the questions they ask. And when I explained all those things, they say no way, because no way that most of common people can live like that, because they were told that only about 1% of people in the United States have everything. Rest of them are living in poverty. And this is what they were told throughout their lifetime.
Well, interviews like that one with KUOW got back to North Korea. And today, the country's official news agency called Kenneth Bae a filthy object and a Judas who betrayed North Korea's humanitarian gesture of releasing him. It accused the U.S. government of supporting critics of North Korea like Bae in order to arouse hostility toward that country. Remember that North Korea is still holding at least two other Americans for alleged crimes like espionage and subversion. We're tweeting out a link to that interview that we did with Kenneth Bae now. We are tweeting at KUOW. KUOW's The Record. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Bill Radke. When Danny Aschini was about 11 years old, she knew she was not a boy, even though everyone else thought she was.
I didn't know a single trans person for almost 7 years in my youth. I mean, if you can imagine going 7 years, being certain of something, and then never having another example of that, never meeting another person like you. I used to jokingly call myself a snow leopard. It's like, I was very unique and, you know, there were no other snow leopards around. And that just created a sense of isolation and a lack of certainty. Like, how could this thing that I knew to be true about myself really be true if nobody else that I'd ever met had experienced that?
Danny Aschini is now executive director of the Gender Justice League here in Seattle. And she says the trans rights movement still has a long way to go, but that she's seen a lot of good changes for trans people since the days when she felt like a snow leopard.
We've seen just like a huge increase in everybody's consciousness about things. As the world becomes more global and much more small, certainly trans people have been able to mobilize across communities, across the country, break that isolation that many of us have felt, and to have more connectedness that has created an incredible amount of possibility. And to be able to share that, YouTube, Tumblr, Facebook, Twitter, to be able to rapidly share an analysis, a critique, evolving language to describe how people feel, all of those things, the internet has actually really revolutionized for trans people how we experience our gender, and our gender has evolved as a culture, I think, much more rapidly because of the internet.
When you Google the word transgender today, do you know the next word that gets automatically filled in?
I don't, but I know that we worked with Google to change that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, today the word is bathroom.
That's funny.
How do you feel about that?
It's exhausting. That's the one word that comes to mind, and sad. You know, it used to be, I actually recall about 3 years ago, several transgender activists approached Google because when they first started their autofill-in, it was like transgender sick, transgender evil, transgender ill. So Google has done some work to change that autofill feature. But I think it's sad that we're stuck on something so basic as where people go to the bathroom, which seems to miss the whole point of, you know, that we live in a pluralistic society in which transgender people are part of the fabric of our lives. Transgender people are, you know, teachers, nurses, doctors, neuroscientists, engineers, and hopefully elected officials very soon. And I think when we get so focused on something like where people can go to the bathroom, it trivializes and misses the point that there are a lot of other issues that transgender people face, and that is actually the smallest concern when it comes to where our conversation should be at.
So to be clear, what conversation should we be having?
I think we should be having a conversation about ending discrimination on the basis of gender identity and expression, ensuring that transgender people have access to jobs, ending violence against transgender people of color. So this last year, 24 transgender women were murdered. 23 of them were transgender women of color. Already this year, we've seen 11 transgender women murdered. We should be having a conversation about how we stop that epidemic, which is really impacting my community. There are a lot of other conversations that we should be having about what it means to be a transgender person navigating a system in which we have two gender options, and our state enforces those, and our culture enforces those. There's a lot of other conversations outside of where people go tinkle. It's just it feels for me in the crisis that my community is facing quite trite in some ways.
The second word Google automatically fills in after bathroom is celebrities, transgender celebrities. Then it's transgender definition. And when I see that, I picture somebody being curious. And I want to ask you, Danny, I've heard you and other transgender people say that you don't appreciate being asked about your genitals, and mm-hmm. I'm not going to. But I would like to know, what do you want people to do with their curiosity?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I think part of the reason why trans people don't like to be asked about their genitals is that we don't go around asking cisgender people about their genitals. And so I think of that as like a common courtesy in public that we just don't ask strangers about what their genitals look like, because it's objectifying and disrespectful.
But is there a way for people to handle an open-hearted curiosity about something they don't know about?
I think the thing I encourage people to do is like ask themselves why they feel the need to know that information, and to really dig into what it is that they're trying to get at. Is it that they're trying to understand, like, oh, what your genitals look like determines how I see your gender? And what is the attachment to that? Why do you feel so attached to that? I think in any other instance, if I told people, I'm sorry, you have to have a surgery before I recognize your PhD, or you have to undergo a medical procedure before I recognize, you know, your worthiness to serve on city council, I think that would be really strange for people. And it's, I think, strange for trans people to feel like our culture is trying to compel us to conform our bodies to some sort of norm that other people have, rather than encouraging us to live our lives authentically to who we are. And there are a lot of reasons why people can't or don't want to have surgery, health reasons, personal reasons. And some people just are comfortable with, you know, living their lives and being seen by their friends and family for the gender that they see themselves as. So I think what I want people to look at and ask trans people is like, what is your life like? How can I respect you? How can I help you? How can I not objectify you and treat you like I would treat anybody else? And then to ask some really critical questions about why do we make gender so important in our culture, and what does that really mean? Many of us espouse views that we believe women are equal to men, but yet the gender pay gap persists, right? The proof is in the pudding in some ways. And so I think trans people elucidate for people a bigger problem in our society, which is about gender in general. And we oftentimes become the lightning rod upon which people project their feelings about gender, which is incredibly unfair. Most of us are, you know, trying to just live our lives and not be discriminated against and be safe in our day-to-day life.
Yeah, do you ever get sick of getting interviewed about differences and minority status and everything that, you know, I haven't ever talked to you about anything else once the microphones roll.
It's true. I mean, I it's funny. One of the conversations that my partner and I have been having, you know, he comes from a very conservative Muslim family, and we've been talking a lot about identity. Like, I use identity to do my work, to do my activism, and to create safety for my community. And identity is a component. Like, we have to build a community around that identity. But it also prevents people from seeing the other parts of me, like that I'm an avid rock climber, or that I love to bike ride, or, you know, that I've traveled a great deal and lived in a bunch of other countries. Like, a lot of people don't know those things about me, those experiences that are just as important to, like, who I am in the world. You know, like, I wish I was a rock climbing activist. I don't know. I
mean, right.
It's a very Northwest way to think about it. But, you know, it's those things that often get dropped out when you kind of just become, your identity becomes the focus of all conversations.
I'm speaking with rock climbing activist Danny Aschini. I have the impression, Danny, that Americans have considered the rights of lesbians, gays, and bisexuals, the LGB, and now we're moving on to the T. How do you feel about that storyline?
You know, it's interesting. Trans people have always been in the LGBT community. Many of us have been activists. You know, I worked on several same-sex marriage campaigns, worked on a lot of non-discrimination campaigns. I think it's in some ways thrilling, exhilarating, exciting. I'm so glad we're here. I feel like I've been waiting for 2 decades to be here, and exhausting and disappointing at times. I sometimes feel like, you know, even within the LGBT community, trans folks have often been at the back of the bus, and in the sense that, like, our labor has been used, that people have been excited that we've contributed to the cause, but people always told us to wait our turn to have these conversations. And now that it is our turn, it's been very difficult to galvanize the same kind of support to build a multiplicity of trans leaders. Like, I know a bunch of incredible trans activists who could be doing the work that I'm doing, but it seems often that there's only space for one or two of us at a time.
Why is that?
That's a really good question. I don't know. I don't know why. I ask myself that question a great deal. You know, I think some of it is people only want a specific spokesperson that looks a particular way, that talks a particular way, that speaks to a certain segment of America, that will only speak about certain issues. Who
sounds moderate. Acceptable transgender spokesperson?
I think for the moment I am, right now.
What's so acceptable about you?
It's a good question. I mean, I think I'm white, which has a lot to do with it. I come off as very middle class. I look, you know, I pass as a cis woman. Most people outside of my life as an activist don't know that I'm trans. I am articulate because I've been talking about this for 20 years. So there's this sense that people drive towards that as, like, you become the spokesperson. And it's hard. They want the mayor of Transtown, which is our internal joke.
You're the mayor of Transtown?
Sometimes within our organization, we joke, you know, at this moment. And hopefully that will change. Hopefully people will not know who I am in 5 years. I don't know. But we have that internal, like, we're in this moment where everybody's paying attention, and we have not built the bench deep enough because there have not been the resources in our community to have a bunch of prepared trans leaders ready, in part because we've been shut out of past campaigns, in part because we haven't been allowed to take leadership positions or have experienced discrimination, like, you know, in the marriage equality campaign. Gender justice.
You feel like you were discriminated, like, trans people have been discriminated against among gays and lesbians and, for example, the same-sex marriage?
Yeah, push? I don't think that's a controversial, I don't think that's a controversial contention even within the LGBT community. I think most people that you would ask would say, yeah, trans people have not been elevated to leadership. Just like, I think LGBT people of color experience an immense amount of adversity in trying to elevate into leadership positions within our community. So there's that also intra-community dynamic, like, or, you know, like inside of our own dynamic that's been difficult. Mm. And, you know, our organization started when we were fighting for marriage equality in Washington State, and that's not a coincidence. I think many of us felt like we didn't have a seat at that table and decided like we wanted to forge and create an organization on our own to elevate the issues that we felt were pressing. And here we are fighting about bathrooms several years later.
That's Danny Aschini, Executive Director of the Gender Justice League. As we told you, there is this state initiative, 1515, that has to do with limiting people's ability to use the bathroom or locker room of the gender they identify with. That Washington State voter initiative is being circulated around now, signatures being collected. We have invited the sponsors of that initiative to come on KUOW's The Record and talk about how they look at transgender issues in 2016. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in today. In health news, just in, an experimental vaccine for the Zika virus is due to start human testing in the coming weeks. Inovio Pharmaceuticals said today it's got clearance from the federal government to start early-stage safety tests of a DNA-based vaccine against this mosquito-borne virus.
This vaccine, you know, if it works as intended, would prevent people from becoming infected with the virus. It would basically prime their immune system so it can fight off the virus. So even if they did get bitten by one of these mosquitoes that carries it, they wouldn't get sick.
That's AP correspondent Matthew Perrone. Inovio plans to start a 40-person study in the coming weeks to figure out the safest dose of the vaccine. You're listening to KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information.
Everybody having a good time? Of course you are.
KUOW's The Record. Thanks for joining us. I'm Bill Radke. In a week and a half, Washington's medical marijuana storefronts will disappear. They'll be folded in to our state-regulated system. Any medical dispensaries without a state license could have their marijuana seized. The person who sponsored our legal marijuana law says she's worried that too many medical providers are being left out. Here's KUOW's law and politics reporter Amy Radel.
The ACLU's Allison Holcomb led the campaign for Initiative 502, which legalized recreational marijuana in Washington state. She says it's the right step now to bring medical marijuana providers out of the gray market and into the state system. But Holcomb fears many will fail.
It's still too expensive to open a business, too difficult to find a location, too difficult to comply with some of the regulations, and there's not enough guidance from agency officers in many cases.
State officials say they've almost doubled the number of marijuana retail stores to accommodate medical providers, but they received 10 times that many applicants. So many will be excluded from the legal system. In contrast, Holcomb says there was no quota on liquor licenses when prohibition ended, which helped get rid of the black market.
I just worry that we're making it too difficult for people that are trying to operate businesses in good faith to do so successfully.
Yeah, I think the system is difficult. It's not something that we created. It's in the initiative.
That's Rick Garza, director of the Washington State Liquor and Cannabis Board. He says the difference with prohibition is that marijuana is still illegal under federal law. So his agency has to impose tight regulations even as they try to draw providers into the system. A consultant's report last year estimated that in Washington, 37% of the marijuana is supplied by medical providers. Retail stores and the black market have slightly smaller shares. As of July 1st, Garza says unlicensed medical providers could face enforcement actions and civil penalties.
If we're aware of a dispensary or in a collective that's not licensed or registered with the state, we will likely go in and confiscate all of the marijuana that's at that premises.
If they continue to operate, they could face criminal charges as well. But many medical marijuana providers have been preparing for this deadline and have already sought a license or closed their doors. Meanwhile, some local governments have banned state-licensed marijuana businesses, at least temporarily. Last week, Holcomb said those bans would aid the black market. She urged the King County Council to do away with its current moratorium on marijuana businesses in unincorporated areas.
The harder we make it for people to enter that marketplace, the more likely it is that it will be reserved for the privileged. King County does not want to be on the wrong side of this debate.
King County Councilmember Kathy Lambert responded that local governments are trying to troubleshoot the unintended consequences of the law, including what she called the odor situation near some marijuana growers.
And they make me gag. I could not live next to them. And to say that we are trying to do this because we are getting in the way, we are setting the course for the country.
The Liquor and Cannabis Board's Rick Garza says 222 additional retail licenses have been distributed to accommodate medical providers. Many local governments objected. He says Seattle was the only city whose mayor and city attorney asked for more marijuana retail stores than the 48 they are now allotted. I'm Amy Radel, KUOW News.
And you're listening to The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Do you love Seattle's quality of life and humming economy, but hate how expensive it is? Maybe you're being unreasonable. I mean, can one city have it all? Here to tell us about that is Seattle Times economics columnist John Talton. Hi, John.
Hi, Bill.
You've been learning how hard it is for cities to be in that sweet spot of desirable and fruitful and affordable.
Well, this is not new news, but I'm in debt to Josh Lerner at the Oregon Office of Economic Analysis, who came up with this cool little Venn diagram of three circles, and he calls it the housing trilemma and sets cities in it. One circle is quality of life, one circle is a strong economy, and one circle is housing affordability, and there's very few metro areas that fit right in the center of all three.
Yeah, what are the cities that do manage to be all three things at once?
Well, some of this is a matter of taste, but he lists Des Moines and Omaha and Oklahoma City
as having as being affordable. I get that. As being, I guess, having pretty good economies. I didn't know that. What's so good about these Midwestern economies?
Well, Oklahoma City has oil, of course, and oil company headquarters. It's hurting a little bit now because of lower oil prices. Omaha has Warren Buffett and some corporate headquarters, and Des Moines has some corporate headquarters. And one of the most important things is these cities have not seen population overshoot. And so they're not these big honking metro areas like Phoenix sitting down there with a bunch of low-paid jobs. And so they have just about the right population.
And according to this researcher, they have the number three, which is quality of life, which means what? What's so great about the quality of life in OKC, Omaha, and Des Moines?
Well, this is where we get into matters of taste. I know Oklahoma City the best, and so Oklahoma City has civic stewards. It has a real downtown. It has some cultural assets. It has some cool in-town neighborhoods. Now, on the other hand, you got wind and you got tornadoes. You've got cold winters and hot summers. And so if you're from Seattle, that's pretty thin gruel. But all in all, they fit in that the middle of the trilemma.
Okay, again, if you're just tuning in, we're talking about the rare city that is affordable and has a quality of life and has a good economy going. By the way, footnote in here that you pointed out, I was surprised to see that Portland is less affordable than San Francisco by this researcher's lights.
It is right now. Portland has seen a tremendous in-migration. Again, like Seattle, you're talking about one of the most desirable cities in the country. And it's also supposedly where young people go to retire.
Mm-hmm.
I chose the wrong parents to let that happen.
Sorry.
And so right now, Portland has an affordability issue that's even worse than Seattle's.
So, and we've been talking, of course, how Seattle has two, but surprise, surprise, it doesn't have a third. It's expensive to live here. So what is what's the takeaway from all this, John? What are you supposed to do or think about because of this information?
Well, we live in an age where the middle class has been hollowed out by a lot of economic policies over the past 35 years. And we also live in an age where technology and offshoring and globalization has taken away a lot of the jobs that used to exist in the middle. And so you have a good number of people making high wages. You have a lot of people making low wages. And you have fewer and fewer in the middle, and this brings in affordability. Then there's local policies like, are we building enough housing?
And so you advocate what, with all this knowledge in mind, what should I, how should I be different now?
Well, we have a fine whine here in Seattle, as we've talked about before, W-H-I-N-E. You know, we are a world city. We are a global destination. People come here from all over the world. And we have top technology companies, and we can't have it all. Want an affordable house? Move to Detroit. But you have to be in Detroit. No offense to Motown. These aren't easily solved problems.
Don't whine if you're not triple great. Double great's pretty great. John Talton, economics columnist from Seattle Times. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Bill.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW. Listen, it's not your cell phone's fault if it doesn't work when you're in Sound Transit's underground light rail tunnel. I found out, thanks to Jamala Henderson's work here, there's no working network yet. She talked to Bruce Gray of Sound Transit, who says it took a little longer than expected to find a vendor to put it in and maintain it, and he hopes that they get the Husky Stadium station wired up and working by the end of August.
The idea is that later this fall, you'll have cell service throughout the tunnels from UW all the way to the International District Station. From there, early next year, we want to activate Beacon Hill Station, Beacon Hill Tunnels, and the underground station there.
The good news is you can hack this situation. You can just subscribe to KUOW's podcast. Make sure your downloads have updated before you go underground, and then enjoy the station down under. It's all there for you on your device. Thanks for tuning in to KUOW.